One, two, three. One, two, three.
Hi, everybody. I'm Scott.
Hello, I'm Julie.
And this is A Good Story is Hard to Find podcast,
where two Catholic friends talk about the books and movies they love and the one reality that lies below the surface.
Yeah. Yeah. And this is episode number 74, the first episode of season three.
Happy New Year.
Yes. Happy New Year to you. Yeah. So this is the beginning of our third year.
Yes, it is.
And going strong.
Mm-hmm.
Hey, today we're going to talk about a documentary called Muscle Shoals, which was terrific.
I'm so glad you liked it.
Because I really did, yeah.
Yeah, I was so excited after I saw it, and then we watched it again in preparation for this, and the girls were here, and they both went, oh, that was really interesting. And I was like, what? No, oh my gosh, you're supposed to love it. So it made me nervous.
Oh, no. No, I like a good documentary, and this was beautiful, too. I mean, the shots of Muscle Shoals is a town in Alabama.
A tiny town.
What'd they say, 8,000? 8,000 mm-hmm. people or something? And, gosh, a lot of the shots were just gorgeous.
Yes, and they really did a wonderful job of establishing a sense of place, which is, I think, what surprised so many people when the music sound of Muscle Shoals started emerging from here, because every so often they'll be talking to an entertainer and getting their stories about how working with these people changed their music or helped them refocus on their career somehow. And then when they're done, you're so immersed in the story, it could be anywhere, Motown or someplace like that. And then they pull away and show you again the bucolic outside or the cotton fields or the little tiny town. And then somebody will talk about how they grew up there. And you suddenly are put back in that sense of place. You're never allowed to lose that.
Yeah, that's a really good point. You know, and don't forget the river.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, the river was kind of a big part of... They kept showing the river, the Tennessee River.
Yes. And beautiful. They start off with that legend about the river sings. The Indians had a story that there was a maiden who sang in the river
mm-hmm.
to them. And what I thought was interesting also is they would keep coming back to the water. For instance, Helen Keller grew up around there, and her first word was water. And I was like, well, that seems like a coincidence. But on the other hand, it makes a lovely strand of kind of illustrating how they would tell the story of the place, as well as the people from there who kind of came together for that. What did Aretha Franklin call it? That funky, greasy sound?
Yeah, I'm sure that the word funky was used more in this movie than any other movie I've seen. I'm like, okay, what is the definition of funky? And it's like one of those things you can't really put your finger on, but you know it when you hear it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's how I feel about it anyway.
Yeah, and that's kind of what they were doing with this movie, is they were describing that ephemeral thing that is art and music.
Yeah.
And how the coming together of people can change what you know into something new and exciting.
Yeah, and that's what excited me most about this. You know, I really love hearing people talk about their creative process. Like one of the things I got over the holidays, Guillermo del Toro, one of mm-hmm. my favorites.
Right.
He has a new book out called Cabinet of Curiosities.
Oh, which, I think I saw that.
Yeah, which contains a whole bunch of his notebooks and things. I love looking at that kind of stuff. And I love in Muscle Shoals, you know, them talking about their creative process and how somehow this place had this magical, you know, not all of them could put their finger on what it was that was so special about this place. But obviously, something is going on there that is contributing to this success, this sound that they've got. And you can say, well, it's this group of people that they're in, or it's the place, you know. And I know that I've talked on this podcast before about the concept of a thin place.
Right.
Yeah, it's a Celtic Christian, or it may not even be Christian, but it's a Celtic idea that there are places on the earth where heaven is closer than in other places. And I like a lot, you know, creative people, when you're talking, you know, whether they're writers or musicians or something, I really like when they talk about how sometimes it feels like it's coming from somewhere else.
Mm-hmm,
and they're like discovering it rather than creating it.
Right.
I really enjoy when they talk about that aspect of certain things that they do. And you really get that feeling, especially, I don't know, Bono was in this. I really don't know how he's connected to it all. It's almost like he's a, you know, a music historian or something talking about Muscle Shoals. But I don't know, I mean, if he even ever recorded there.
No, that was the criticism that I had and that a lot of people, when you read about it, had. They all said, what was Bono doing in this? He's talking very authoritatively.
He is, yeah.
They keep coming back to him. And I kept thinking, is it because he would talk about it? Or
yeah, I don't know. And even Mick Jagger surprised me. Mm-hmm. Mick Jagger, who did record there, in this documentary, was speaking like, you know, boy, I really... You know, like he knew a lot of stuff. I don't know why it surprised me. I mean, the guy's in the music industry, and he's talking about Aretha Franklin and how at CBS she wasn't able to click there, and only when she got to Muscle Shoals she started to click. And it was just interesting to me that he knew Aretha Franklin's music from CBS and before she started to do all this stuff that she's really famous for. I don't know why that surprised me, but it was interesting to me that to hear him talk about that as if, you know, the whole history of music was something that he really spent a lot of time thinking about.
I know. I guess we tend to think of them as isolated or only paying attention to maybe say the Beatles, because those were their, you know, contemporaries. Whereas really a lot of those people were so influenced by what they listened to and watched when they were kids, or, and not that she was, you know, a childhood influence on them, but just all this other stuff, because that's what they always say about the Beatles are the ones I've heard it for. But in, of course, the Stones, you could hear the blues influence on their rock and roll, right?
Yeah, sure.
They were getting that from the U.S., and using it in their music. And then everybody who was influenced here by the British invasion started using that influence. And that was one of those places where you could see it going back and forth. If you pay attention, my husband pays attention. He was the one who kind of taught me to listen for it more. But and the thing that's kind of funny is what nobody expected was this teeny tiny little place to have anybody who played with a sound, or even a producer like Rick Hall, who's the main person they highlight in this movie, to have an ear that knew how to kind of highlight something that made their own sound, each artist's own sound, unique to them, but still using this same band, the Swampers, as the background. And then you listen to them talking, and a lot of these artists are black, and they'll be going, and here are these guys, and they look like they work down at a grocery store or something, because they're just white country boys, basically. And they're all dressed... not really hip, especially at the beginning. And they show up and you're just like, they have that sound that went behind Aretha?
Yeah,
but, you know, that's that something. Mix of influences too.
Yeah, I forgot which specific person it was, but there was one guy who was dressed in coveralls with a shirt over it, sitting at a keyboard talking. You know, I they didn't show his feet, but I pictured work boots. And
well, that Spooner, I think, is his
name. No, Spooner was a real skinny guy.
Oh, okay.
It was a guy who was talking about Spooner. He was talking about Aretha Franklin and how she walked in the room. It was the guy that was describing that.
Okay.
And but anyway, it just feeds to what you're saying. You know, these guys just grew up around there, and it was like, why, you know, just this. Yeah. Again, you know, what this special group of people just clicked together and made stuff happen.
Yeah, and they talked about some of their own influences, which are just the way anybody else would have influences. And so maybe that's part of why Rick Hall is so important to this, because he's essentially, I guess you'd say, he's the producer and engineer
for
his studio, which was Fame. And it was, you think it's about being famous, but it's, I can't remember what it was, but it's something like, you know, Muscle Shoals music or something like that.
Yeah.
But he talks about his life, and my goodness, as the movie goes on and more of his life is revealed, which was done in a very artful way, I thought, so that it kind of went along with his career, you saw this is a man who has lived the blues. I mean, the way his wife died, his first wife died, you could see he could blame himself for that. The story about his three-year-old brother and his mother who abandoned them, and the father and how he died. And each time he had to pick himself back up and come back from that personally. And then what he saw as a huge betrayal from the Swampers when they would leave and form their own studio. And but from their side, when they're talking, you can see them just saying it was time for us to do something on our own.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to hurt him, but it was time to move on. And then he says it was war. And it occurred to me this morning thinking about it, they never talk about what that meant. But you know, there had to be a lot of, in a town that small, there had to be a lot of divisiveness.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Yeah. These people would bump into each other. They would have to, you know?
Yeah. And think of the clients they were all trying to get, where the Swampers said for 8 or 9 months, there was nothing. And the guy who encouraged them to break off brought Cher in, and nothing happened. Because then I'm like, well, duh, that's not Cher at all. Come on, really?
Yeah.
Not that they couldn't adapt themselves to style, but...
Right, right.
It just wasn't her.
Yeah.
And then the other thing is, so you've got the story, the strand about the town, and really it's about the countryside and the surroundings, where they'd pull out and show some of this, and people talk about growing up, where the one guy says... He was the drummer, I think, and he'd say they lived so far out of town they'd walk 5 miles to get to the bus stop to go to the grocery store when he was a little kid. Yeah. And they grew up dirt poor. So every so often somebody would tell their story like that to give you this perspective. And then you had the stories of Rick Hall, and also, as this it goes on, of the Swampers. But then you also have, they tell the artists who came and how it changed what they were doing. And so you've got Aretha Franklin talking, and other people, of course. And then I can't believe how many videos were being taken.
Yeah, that was surprising. Yeah, it's like they said, oh, we should record all this.
I know.
The first really interesting story to me from the artist standpoint was Wilson Pickett.
Who he was fascinating.
Yeah, but I was really enthralled by everything that Aretha Franklin was in. But yeah, Wilson Pickett, so here they are, a brand new studio, and I forgot, was it, that guy from New York, Drexler, I think? Did he send Wilson
Drexler,
Pickett down there?
Aaron okay. Drexler, yeah. He said, I think, brought him down.
He said, yeah, let's go make some records.
Yeah.
And I love that. Yeah. Let's go make some records. So they send him down there to Alabama, and he's, not too impressed at the beginning. He sees this Rick Hall show up. And, he's not all that impressed with him, to say the least. He's like, how is he going to help me do anything?
Well, you know, this white guy. An unflattering reaction from the very beginning.
Yeah, exactly.
And Rick Hall's like, and he just looked dangerous. And then they're getting in the car and they're driving to the studio. Mm. And he's like, am I seeing what I think I'm seeing? Says Wilson Pickett. And he's like, yeah, that's people picking cotton. And he's like, yeah, he's a New York African American man who's, these are times when it's very contentious and people are fighting for freedom, and he's got kind of a chip on his shoulder.
Yeah.
And so it was uncomfortable. But what happened in the studio, and this is what everybody talks about, and I think this is what makes that thin place that you're talking about. Nobody worried about color or rank or anything. Everybody says, and he especially, Wilson Pickett, would say, once you got in there, you're a musician among musicians. It wasn't like you're the talent and we're the backup. And that was obviously the case. But when they were working on a musical situation, they were just working on it together.
Yeah. Yeah. He said they created the music together. They would kind of put some things together. They'd go to lunch. They'd come back. They'd say, we need to remove that. You know, nobody's getting upset. You know, this needs to come out. That needs to go in. And then eventually it would just click and it would be like, oh, That's it. That mm-hmm. is exactly it. And now Rick Hall, an interesting aspect of him, you know, a lot of things are compared to Steve Jobs, you know. You know, Steve yeah. Jobs' style of things, which was pretty difficult. But,
yeah.
you know, so, you know, when I hear Rick Hall, you know, them talking about Rick Hall, one of the aspects of Rick Hall is that he was difficult. And
he knew what he wanted.
He knew what he wanted. Yeah. And, you know, that's the same way that Jobs was. I just find that interesting because, you know, I'm not that way. I'm not really a manager anyway, but I'm like, you know, somebody else has a different way. I'm willing to say, yeah, let's try that.
Mm-hmm.
Not saying that Rick Hall didn't do that, but Rick Hall knew what he wanted, and he wouldn't be, you know, one artist described it, you know, we're going to play the same song for 3 days until he hears what he wants. Even if he doesn't know exactly what it is that's missing, he's going to keep doing it until he hears it. And he says, aha, that's it.
Right.
And, you know, he was willing to do whatever it took to get that. And Wilson Pickett, who himself was very strong-willed, mm-hmm. somehow they got along. And you'd think that that relationship was doomed, but
I know.
It worked great. In fact, he said that, you know, after that first day, this is Wilson Pickett, after that first day, I could see this as my recording home. And he came back again and again and again mm-hmm. after that.
And it influenced his career in ways that you wouldn't expect, because at one point, it was, which one was it? Greg Allman?
Uh-huh. Oh, yeah.
Or Dwayne.
Right.
Which it was, one died? It was, I can't remember, of the Allman Brothers.
Yeah, right. I know
he
exactly.
wanted to work at Muscle Shoals so much he slept in the parking lot till they tried him. And then they were like, my goodness, this guy does amazing things. And he's the one who went to Wilson Pickett and said, hey, why don't you record Hey Jude? And he's like, no, I'm trying to make my own music. He's like, just try it, man. Come on. I think you'd be great. And then I'm listening to the cover, which I don't know if I've ever heard, going, wow. Somebody who did his own thing with it and didn't ruin the song.
Mm-hmm.
Amazing.
Yeah.
As Hannah said, she was like, I think I might like this better than the Beatles. I was like, yeah, I know, right?
Yeah.
It's never been a favorite song of mine.
It was great. It really yeah. was.
Well, and yep. that's the, but that point of Steve Jobs and Rick Hall, and you'll hear about these kind of people like Bill Gates.
Mm-hmm.
He was Mr. Nice Guy to the world, but he was like that, I think.
Right, right.
He had Steve Ballmer to be his hitman, so to speak, his Darth Vader to the public and to everybody. But he's the one who knew what he wanted. And I think if you're going to achieve something extraordinary, there are different methods to present yourself. But if you don't, if you're not striving for some goal like that, even if you don't know exactly what it is, you're not going to be the person who drives the process, basically.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, there needs to be some of that there, you know. If you're going to be in charge and you've got this vision, you've got to try to bring people into your vision, and the people that are outside that vision are going to look at you as a very mean person. You know what I mean?
Right,
yeah,
right.
Yeah, so, I think that that's normal.
And it never got talked about on the Swampers, but the one guy, and of course I don't remember any of the names, but eventually the one guy who does most of the talking about when they were in their own studio, he says, whoa, we didn't have an engineer. I had to be the engineer. But by the time they get to talking about Lynyrd Skynyrd and how they helped discover them and what he went through trying to get Freebird on the radio, you see that he's become that person.
Yeah,
he may not be quite as hard-edged in person, but he's the one who's this is something amazing, and I'm not going to quit. And I hadn't really thought about that from that point of view until us talking.
yeah, and then the Swampers were really interesting guys. I mean, I loved that story. The whole story of those what was it? Well, yeah. there was more than three guys, but it seemed to be like three main guys. But
I think they're the ones who are still alive. I think there were six of them, and the others are dead now.
I'm with you. Yeah. And artist after artist just marveled at how these guys were the rhythm section, the band that's permanently there at this studio is mm-hmm. the Swampers, right? Mm-hmm. And how they were able to adapt to any style of music, anything that these guys were doing, and how they were able to just make it happen. I don't even know what the words are, but, you know, just being able to get in the groove or whatever with right. whoever's there. And I just find that amazing.
I know. Well, and to me, that was pointed up most when it was Jimmy Cliff, I think his name is, talking yeah. about sitting in limbo, mm-hmm. because that's the one where I was like, oh, those guys did that, and you're listening, and it just sounds pure Caribbean or Jamaican amazing. Or whatever yeah. that song would be, and you're just thinking, and one of the guys says, well, we viewed that as our job, and maybe that's part of what their magic was, is they're like, we were to be their band. We yeah. were to help them get to the sound that they had and bring out their potential, not about right, ours.
Yeah. You weren't there to make them listen to you. You were there to right. serve them.
Right.
Yeah, I think that's great.
Yeah, because I also really enjoyed the pieces that they had recorded of the Stones, the Rolling Stones recording session that they had there, where they would show them listening to the music being played back. And you could see them going, oh, yeah, yeah, that, oh, right, that's perfect.
Mm.
You know?
Yeah. The Rolling Stones section was great. Keith Richards was there, you know, Keith Richards, man. I just can't believe that guy. I just love it. I mean, he's just got this, I can't stop watching that guy. I mean,
agreed.
Yeah, I just can't, you know, just amazing.
He was just so fun. Except the only thing is you'd look at him and you go, whoa, fake choppers, man.
Yeah,
whoa,
yeah.
Whoa, too white.
Did you notice his fingers?
Other than that.
The tips of his fingers, did you happen to notice that?
No, I didn't.
Oh, man. I mean, his knuckles were so big on the ends of his fingers. They were huge.
Oh, I didn't notice that.
Yeah, yeah.
Well, that years and years of playing the guitar.
Amazing, yeah.
That is amazing.
Yeah.
How interesting. And I also really liked the way that they interviewed all these people. Each one had their own setting. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, they showed a lot of space around them. You know, they always were showing people from pretty much the same angle when they were talking. You know, Keith Richards and Mick Jagger, you were fairly close to Aretha Franklin. You were sitting far back from, and there was another guy. Oh, who is it? The guy who sang Patches, which I was like, I hated that song. So I remember when it was on the radio, Tom said the same thing. He's like, I guess I'm glad somebody liked it, but... But you heard them talking about the genesis of that song, and that whoever that artist was, he said, well, I didn't want to sing it, but if Rick Hall said it would work, I was going to sing it. That's how much trust he had in him because he made his career.
Clarence Carter, that was who that was.
That's it.
Yeah.
That's it. Well, I would say, too, that the reason I loved this documentary for a couple of reasons. Well, several reasons. One is that the music was amazing. And the whole time I saw it in the theater, in my head, I was dancing. And there was a guy who was sitting near us who was dancing in his seat almost the entire time. And he must have been exhausted by the time the movie was done, because this is a 2-hour documentary. And when I was watching it the first time, I kept saying, oh, no, now it's going to stop. Oh, it's not. And so to me, it didn't feel long.
It didn't feel long to me at all. I mean, that time flew by. I was... enthralled the entire time.
Okay, so yeah, okay, good. And me too. And so the music is one thing, because it's the music that I grew up with, or most of us have heard in America for sure. And then I was really struck by the way that Rick Hall and the Swampers emerged together. You know, Rick Hall was the driving force, but he needed them, and they needed him, obviously. So that shows their path together. And the town, the way it was constantly put in a sense of place where this all happened. But the thing, of course, that really struck me was Rick Hall's redemptive story. And I can't believe I'm talking about this and almost getting a little broken up here. But here's a man who had a hard life, and he said he wanted to be special. And you can see that, because rejection is what led him to making him prove himself.
Mm-hmm.
But in the end, what you see is what makes all of them full people is forgiveness. Because he says, and several times different people would say, well, time passes, things change.
Mm-hmm.
And by the end of the movie, I was so longing for him to express some understanding of the Swampers leaving, that when it showed them shaking hands and playing in the studio for him, I was almost tearing up. It was very moving to me.
It was moving to me too. Yeah. For the exact same reason. You know, that did cause me tension, you know, when in the movie, you know, they split, I was like, oh,
I know.
Like, oh no, you know, and then, cause I knew nothing about Muscle Shoals at all, nothing. So everything was a revelation to me watching this movie.
Yeah.
But it was as enthralling as a fictional film. I mean, remarkable, you know, and then that, the whole redemptive story, the whoever directed this thing, who did? Greg Freddy Camelier. Yeah. He did a great job with that.
And the other amazing thing is he is a first-time director.
Oh, really?
Wow. I believe, and we'd have to look it up, but I believe he's a real estate guy from Colorado or somewhere who was vacationing and happened upon Muscle Shoals in his vacation and was so astounded by what he found there that he said, well, we have to tell people. We have to make a movie about this.
Wow. Yeah.
And this is his first movie. And I was just blown away because it has the depth of a fictional story, but it's real. I mean, now any documentary is picking and choosing what they're showing you. But it's one of those things where I got done and I said, but this is what we all go through.
Mm-hmm.
To some degree or another, our lives are made up of what makes or breaks us is the other people around us and the choices that we make. Just like Rick Hall, the car accident where his wife died, that wasn't his fault.
Mm-hmm.
That was an accident. The thing with his father, an accident. The thing with his little brother, an accident. But look what his mother did with that. And look at the ripples it sent through everybody's lives.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, that's an encapsulation of each of our stories, in a sense.
Yeah, you're right.
Yeah, and so it's that, yeah, and you can be angry and you can have people betray you, or so you feel, because you can't see their side of the story. And sometimes they are betraying you. People can be awful. But the thing is what do you do with it yourself? What does it take to give you peace? There has to be forgiveness for redemption.
Hmm. Yeah, that's beautiful stuff. Yeah.
Yeah, and that's why I was so moved. I mean, because I've seen, there was a mini part story about Motown on TV, on PBS years and years ago that we watched. And that was interesting and I liked it and it was really good. But it didn't have the human element that made this come alive for me.
Yeah, and it was. Like I said, I was enthralled the whole time. And, you know, the story of Rick Hall, you know, and the story of the Swampers, too. Like I said, I just really enthralled by that. You know, and that was from more of an artistic or a creative aspect or a creative angle. Mm-hmm. But, yeah, the whole thing is a redemptive story. I mean, this would make a terrific movie.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, somebody grab it. Tom Hanks, go get it. I don't know what role he'd play.
Well, I think we already have the movie. We don't need another movie.
Yeah, you're right. We don't.
They could just watch this.
They could, yeah.
And in fact, it's up for, I can't remember what the award is, but my husband, the reason we even heard of this is he, here's a weird connection with Muscle Shoals and also Florence, Alabama, which got mentioned several times, a little town just across the river, I think, is that we have some good friends, a couple who are, they work with Billy Reed, who's a clothing designer. And they were in Dallas and went to our parish and helped with that marriage retreat and everything. And at one point they say, well, we have to move because Billy's going to go live in in Florence, Alabama, which is where he grew up. And he just says there's nothing like it. And he loves the fishing and the music and the everything. And so we have to go live there too.
Hmm.
That's where the business is going to be. And the wife comes back and she's like, it's so small. And she goes, well, it's going to be fine because the kids can walk to school. They can do all these small town things that you can't usually do. But she kept going, it's so tiny. And so when I heard about this, I was really intrigued. And the reason is because once that happened, my husband got onto the Billy Reed email list of promotions. And Billy Reed said, he sent out an email and said, this documentary is so great. that a generous donor is paying for it to go across the country in different theaters because they had trouble getting a distributor, I guess. And it's going to be shown near you. There are free tickets. All you have to do is sign up and go.
Wow.
And so we, and so we went, really? But see, my husband had heard of the Muscle Shoals sound because he is the kind of music lover who, when there were actually albums and you could read the small type on the album covers, he read the details on every album he ever bought, and he had a lot of albums.
How about
that? We still have them.
That's cool.
And so he knew about it, and he was like, oh, we have to go see this. And so that's how we heard of it. And he recently got another email that said they're in the running for some award, movie award, and what they're trying to do is take the emphasis off the subject and give the award for the art of the movie. Because the thing is they have this problem with the Oscars is if you have something about, I don't know, AIDS or some important subject, the one about music is never going to win. Everyone's got to vote for the one on AIDS. That's very important. And he said, so what they're trying to do is look at the artfulness of how it's done, because it's not about the subject. It's about the movie itself and who made it and everything. And this is up for a variety of things like that.
So did Rose see this one?
Yeah.
How did she like it?
She liked it. She said, oh, that was interesting.
As a documentary filmmaker, at least in college, right? I mean, did she think it was special
I guess
in
you're
any
right.
way?
I'll have to. Yeah, I didn't ask her.
I was
that
just curious.
Viewpoint.
Yeah.
Yeah. No, she said she thought it was well done and she didn't have a lot of criticism. You should have heard her on Frozen. Oh, my gosh. The litany of what she hated about that movie never ended.
Oh, that's too funny. That's
which
too funny.
Everybody I know loves.
Yeah,
you,
I liked it.
Friends.
I liked it very much. I thought it was
everybody
good.
Everybody loved it. And she gave the first 5 minutes. A thumbs up. The rest of it, horrible.
I gotcha. That's funny.
But so if she didn't like it, I would have heard.
Well, that's good, because when I was watching it, I mean, there were times, you know, when there was nothing but silence and they were showing just scenes, and I was blown away by the look of it and and how it was put together. You know, as I sit here and I think about it, you know. You mentioned how Rick Hall's, the revelations of Rick Hall's life, you know, those major events in his life, how they were, you know, dispersed throughout the movie. And then, and at the very end, how he led us to this redemptive story. Gosh, really, really good.
Well,
just
I
wonderful.
Know. And if somebody, I assume anybody listening to this has already watched it because they now know our style, which is to tell all. But if people have watched it and didn't watch all the way through the credits, you need to watch through the credits because some of the most important summing up statements of the movie happen there.
Yeah.
Including the one that says the imperfection is the human element, which is what we need today more, basically.
And that was interesting coming from Rick Hall. Yeah,
and coming from Rick Hall.
I'm sorry. He was described as a perfectionist all the time, you know.
Right.
And that's where I got the connection to Steve Jobs and the drive to get something specific. And then to have Rick Hall say, well, you know, the imperfections is what makes it human, which is where the specialness is. And I was like, well, that's a very interesting statement from Rick Hall.
Right.
So fascinating.
Exactly.
Fascinating. Yep.
Well, and it's that thing, it's funny because Tom and I instantly said, that's just what Bob Dylan said on one of his theme time radio hours. I don't know. Have we talked about that?
Yeah, you just not, I don't know if we've talked about it here, so please do, but you've told me about it.
Yeah, and I thought maybe I had sent you one, and if
you sure
not,
did.
I,
yeah.
Oh, did I? Okay.
Yeah.
It used to be on, oh gosh, maybe AOL radio when that was just on the internet, and you could get it if you had a Yahoo account, and Tom did, and he'd listen to some of these radio shows, and he started taping them off of his computer because he was like, these are amazing, and it was really more, I think, the brainchild of the guy who produced it, whose name I can't remember right now. But Bob Dylan, for 3 seasons, and this was like 30 shows a season or so, he would DJ an hour-long theme time radio hour. And they would take weather, marriage, drinking, colors, numbers, food, whatever. And they would do song after song after song. And they would go from country to hip hop, to rock and roll, to anything except, I don't think I ever heard classical on there, but pretty much everything else. because he likes all kinds of music. And then it's interspersed with these dumb jokes. And sometimes part of the charm is Bob Dylan would just tell the joke and then he'd just crack up sometimes, you know. So they'd have fake call-in radio calls, you know, hey, Bob, I wish you'd play something about this or give me some advice about that. And they would turn out, if you looked up the details later, these were actual musicians who had done something for him to call in. And so anybody who discovered it, if you liked that kind of an idea at all, you really loved it. And one of the things, every so often, he would just start talking about something. And he was talking about some song, and he goes, that's one where they recorded it. You can hear mistakes. It doesn't matter. He goes, too much today. It's all about how perfect can you make it sound. And he said, you're losing the music then. You have to have the people. And the people means it's going to be imperfect, but that's where you get the passion of the music.
Fascinating, yeah. Yep.
Yeah.
I think it's the same in writing as well.
Oh, yes.
I remember one writing, I can't remember where I was, but it must have been at a convention. Somebody said, once you write your first draft, you've got to go through it again, obviously. But if you go through it too much, you're going to lose what made it special in the first place. Because you're removing all of this stuff that was, you know, coming from a place in yourself that maybe you don't quite understand.
Yeah, and that's that idea of that thin place that you talked about where people don't know where things are coming from.
Right, right.
And I have discovered that, like, when I'm doing some writing and a lot of times I'll go into the church and I'll sit in front of the tabernacle and write, just handwrite in a notebook. And I'll be typing it in and I'm thinking, oh, well, I need to say this. Oh, I said that and I didn't remember it. Oh, I need to do this. And then I'll discover I did it better, I think, in the handwritten one.
Oh, that's neat.
Yeah. And I don't know if that's just the first iteration or if that's just that letting go a little bit.
Yeah, there's just something there. Yeah. And then in the editing process, it's not as there, but it's, I assume it's there, but you know, you start yanking stuff out and...
Or putting stuff in, or
rewriting it into a way that's less lyrical some way. But it's stuff that you're not noticing in the editing process. You know, it's
right.
Yeah, it's all interesting. You know, the creativity is very interesting.
Yeah, and you wonder how much does the computer contribute to a lack of that? I guess it depends on how you do it. But I think of J.R.R. Tolkien talking about typing the manuscript of The Lord of the Rings. Now, obviously, he worked on, they say if you went up to his rooms, he had like little pieces of paper and stacks of stuff everywhere. So clearly he was thinking about stuff and working it out and everything. But he said he typed the manuscript, then it got sent back and he had to retype it again with any changes. But he didn't have a computer. He couldn't go back through and change it
right,
easily.
Right. Yeah. Yeah, yeah. I think the first thing you need to do if you're going to write is turn off all of the grammar stuff in Word. If you're using Word, turn it all off. Because, yeah, it's going to make everybody the same.
Yeah, exactly.
You just want it all gone.
Yeah, so I guess this movie was, it's about the creative process. It's about being imperfect and still struggling. It's about redemption. It's about what we do to each other, whether deliberately or not. And a lot of that rubs off our sharp edges.
Yeah. Yeah.
You know, that's why we're all meant to be together. That's why we're, that's why living
that's
in isolation.
That's why it's a community.
Yeah.
Yeah,
that's exactly.
The community. Exactly.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, yeah.
Yeah. I just,
yeah. I think it was Ravi Zacharias. I've talked to you about him before. He's a Baptist, but I love to listen to him. And
I do too, actually.
Yeah. And he said, you know, the community and the Trinity, it kind of is an example to us of how, you know, where do we live in community, and things like this are just shine a light on that. You know, this Muscle Shoals town somehow in community has created something incredibly special and unique, and it's remarkable.
Yeah.
And it could only be done in community. Rick Hall couldn't have done it himself.
No.
Nobody could have done it alone, you know?
No.
And,
exactly.
That's an amazing thing that, you know, we humans have.
Well, yeah, exactly. And, you know, they didn't even talk about, there's a whole nother strand in there, which is talking, putting the experience in this town against what's happening nationally and politically at the time, which was integration. And so they would talk about, I remember the funniest thing was when somebody said, you know, well, when it was time for lunch, there was only one place to go. You went to the little diner, and they'd walk in there with, you know, the black people with them, the artist, the main artist, and everybody be giving them the eye. And they said, but it was nothing like when they went in with the Allman Brothers.
Yeah.
They're like, you know,
the
okay,
hippies,
right. Black
hippies,
people's one
man.
Thing, but these hippies, get them out of here.
Oh, it man. Was, you know, and I don't know that I've heard that much about that. I knew it, you know, but
I've lost you again.
Oh, I said...
Hello.
Testing 1, 2, 3.
Okay.
Testing. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Are you there? Okay. Sorry about this. I don't know what's going on.
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
Are you here?
I'm here.
Okay. Okay. Me too.
All right. I don't know. I knew that the hippies were looked down upon by a lot of people, I guess, especially in the South, but
right.
I had no idea that it was that bad. And, In the movie, they said that, you know, going to that diner for lunch, you know, with black people was hard enough on everybody. But when they added him, it became too much. And
yeah.
Those two actually stayed behind. Wilson Pickett and Allman stayed behind.
Right.
And that's when he said, hey, you should record Hey Jude. So
yeah.
they're in the studio messing around while everybody else is at lunch. And, something amazing came out of that, you know.
Mm-hmm.
That's really neat.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it wasn't neat. You know, the discrimination, of course, was not neat, but still, it's just amazing.
No, but that was the thing that person after person brought up and marveled at and said, we weren't black and white. We were just musicians together.
Right, right.
So it was kind of like a microcosm of what was trying to be achieved nationally.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that. And everybody knew needed, well, not everybody, I guess. A lot of people felt needed to happen.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, you'd like to think that in that small town, at least, that everybody would have gotten used to seeing everybody. And it would have become not, you know, not so big a deal. But, you know, the Allman and, I mean, that was way far down the line. That was at least 10 years, 12 years after they opened. You know, that was in the 70s, and they were active through the 60s. So,
well, and I think in some
change
cases,
is hard.
Discrimination. Huh?
I said change is hard.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, it is, and I think in some cases, I think of my father-in-law, who was really prejudiced against black people, or you know, the Japanese. He fought. He was a Marine in World War II. That kind of thing. But as my husband pointed out, you know, he'd make these outrageous statements and we'd just go, no, 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 I don't want my children hearing you say these things. But on a one-on-one basis, he took each person for themselves. When we had that Japanese intern, he loved Maya, thought she was great. Did never stop to say, oh, but she's Japanese. And he was able to work with Japanese businessmen and all this kind of thing. It's that big picture versus the personal picture. And once again, so we get down to person to person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. 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 I agree. You know, one-on-one, I don't know. I mean, that's what changes things though, isn't it? You know,
right?
I mean, they're talking about the music, how, you know, the music helped change the United States.
Mm-hmm.
And, I'm sure it's not done changing, but still, you know, it made things better, you know, and Muscle Shoals was a big part of it.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm so glad you liked it. I, you know, highly recommend, you can find it now streaming. I think there's a DVD that's supposed to come out in late February.
Okay. The way that I got mine was on iTunes.
Okay.
And I could not, it wasn't available for purchase. It was only available for rent, which was interesting. So have you ever rented on iTunes?
I have not.
How it works is you pay your money and then you download it and then you have 30 days to watch it.
Oh, okay.
But the moment you press play, you have 24 hours.
That's clever.
Yeah, so it works well.
That's clever.
Yeah, so...
Yeah, that sounds better than the way Amazon does it for that sort of thing, is from the time you pay, you have 48 hours. Hmm. Maybe it's 30... Well, anyway, I guess it's 48 hours to watch it.
Yeah.
So and we've got we saw it on YouTube.
Okay, cool.
Which Tom was pretty excited about, because that meant we had to go get the Chromecast thing to put on the TV. I mean, we probably
love
use it for work,
it.
Too, by the way. I went, yeah, it's $35. I'll go get you one. He was sick, but I was
that
sick.
That is fantastic. That's yeah. fantastic.
Yeah.
That's cool.
Yeah.
Well, this morning I was thinking, what other documentaries leap to mind that I really like? And I thought of a couple that I've seen recently.
Oh, okay.
I just thought I'd mention it. One of them is called First Position.
You've mentioned that.
Yeah, I thought it was very good. It's about dancing, which is a subject that, you know, I know nothing about.
Mm-hmm.
And it follows several young people as they're, in some cases, being pushed through, and in other cases, being just, you know, some of them are extremely talented and other ones are not, but just going through these dance in preparation for a dance competition.
Mm-hmm.
And by dance, I mean ballet.
Right.
But I thought it was a really impressive documentary. I liked it a lot.
Okay.
And then another one that leaps to my mind that I really like, and this one's a little bit older, but it's called Encounters at the End of the World by Walter Herzog.
Oh, okay.
And it's about Antarctica and people who live down in Antarctica.
Okay.
So, you know, there's a little town there called McMurdo Station. And I just thought it was fascinating, you know.
Okay.
Just talking to the people that live there. I think one of the first people he talked to was a bus driver. You know, it's a little bitty town.
Uh-huh.
And they talk about, I remember him talking about the ice cream machine, how everybody loved the ice cream machine. You know, things become so important when you're
right,
in such a tiny,
right.
tiny spot. And
right. It's truly a tiny town.
Yeah, it really is tiny. You know, down there at the bottom of the world. And
yeah.
It's mostly scientists and a few support people. And, you know, the scientists are usually there temporarily while they're, you know, their experiment may be, you know, 20 miles away or something. So this is like the home base. And then they get trained, you know, if you start getting a blizzard, this is what you need to do, you know, to try to survive. And anyway, I thought it was fascinating. The people, the mix of people, some of them, you know, why do you end up in Antarctica, for heaven's sakes, you know?
Yeah.
Not only the scientists, but, you know, how does this bus driver, how did you get here? You know, what string of things happened that you ended up in Antarctica? And their stories are just interesting. I thought it was really cool.
I have to look for those.
Yeah. And very well shot. Very well shot. It is Walter Herzog. And,
well,
yeah.
yes.
And he and his accent, you know, narrate a whole lot of it.
Of course. I'm trying to think of the name of the one that he did, which was about the French caves that were fairly recently discovered.
Oh, I saw that too. Yeah, the Caves of Forgotten Dreams or something.
That's
like
it.
That.
That was good, although he kind of annoyed me in that, because I feel that the subject matter was thin, though I could have just sat there and looked at that art. Once I learned that it was over a 300,000-year period by people continually coming back and using the art for whatever and looking at it and painting it, I thought, I suddenly just felt connected to those, whatever they looked like, those were people. And I felt so connected. I didn't need Werner Herzog going, perhaps this was happening. Perhaps it was a man and his wolf together and they were friends. And I'm like, pretty sure not. I'm just saying.
Yeah.
You know, that's lovely. But no.
I love it.
The two, it's funny when you say that, because I was like, oh, what would I say? So two documentaries that came to mind. One is one I saw several years ago, and it's called The Tale of the Weeping Camel.
Hmm.
Have you seen that?
No, I've never heard of that one.
It is about nomads in Mongolia.
Uh-huh.
And every so often there is a camel, a mother camel, that will reject her baby. And so their tradition is you have to go find a local person who's a certain kind of a, I would say it's a violin player, but basically it's their local instrument that sounds that's a stringed instrument. And they come and they play to the camel. And when the camel begins weeping, it will accept the baby. And they show this. They show how these people live. They show this happening. And they show this whole thing. And it's the most amazing look into a foreign culture I've ever seen.
Oh, neat.
And Roger Ebert was talking about it, and he said, well, yeah, it's reenacted in the same way that Nanook of the North was reenacted, in that you can't just walk in and have this happen. So you have to go in, and you're showing how they live, and then, oh, here's this situation, and tell us when it's likely to happen, and we'll come and film it, kind of thing.
But right.
It was really astounding. And then the other one is called Earl Garner, They Can't Hear You Read, because he could never read music. And somebody said, we really need to learn how. And he goes, they can't hear you read. They're just listening to me play the piano. And it was a much more straightforward documentary about him as a musician. But what's astounding about it is you really learn to appreciate his gift for improvisation. He never played any song the same. And he never started any song the same. And so eventually what they get down to is showing all these clips of how he'd noodle his way into a song, and his backup musician standing there kind of looking at each other like, I think I've got it. Okay, I think I know where he's going. And then him playing with them going, oh, you've got it? But I'm going to still do this. When am I starting the song? I mean, he was an amazing improviser.
Wow, that's got to be an amazing feeling when you're improvising like that and with more than one person there. And then everybody gets on the same page. That's got to be really something.
It was really interesting to watch, because by the time you got done, you had such an appreciation of him as a musician that we immediately went and bought a couple of his albums.
Oh, cool.
Yeah.
Hmm.
And he is amazing.
Well, neat.
So those are good.
Excellent. I'm going to watch both of those. Cool.
Well, I'm gonna watch both of the ones you mentioned.
Good stuff.
Yes.
All right. Well, I'm so happy to be back here, so thank you.
Oh, well, I'm so glad you liked it.
Heck yeah. So next time, in a couple of weeks, we're going to talk about Community, which is a TV show that we both follow.
Yes.
And that's going to be fun talking. That'll be enjoyable. Yeah.
We have selected certain episodes, and I guess should we do a post or something where we talk about what they are?
Probably should, yeah.
So in case people want to watch them ahead of time.
Okay.
Or
you bet. We'll do that. And then in February, we're going to talk about Lord of the Rings.
Dun, dun, dun. Dun, dun,
yes. Starring Carl Urban.
Oh, and Viggo Mortensen. Let's not forget.
We're going to talk about the books.
Oh, right. Right. But in my head.
I'm just joking. Yes,
when
exactly.
I'm reading the books. We know who I'm seeing.
You bet.
Mostly. Yeah.
So the start of this year is a little bit off what I would call our normal, but I would say in March we'll be back to normal. But February is going to be Lord of the Rings month.
Yep. Definitely.
And I'm sure that will go more than an hour. And we'll either just put the whole thing out there or break it into pieces. I'm not sure yet.
Yeah, we'll see. Debating that. Yeah. So, well, not so much debating as thinking it over.
Exactly. Yep. Yep.
If people have an opinion, let us know, I guess.
Heck yeah. Tam, who I am here mentioning, said, just put the whole thing out there, 3 hours long, or however long it ends up being. Yeah, we've got to select a day in which we have a lot of time to, because I am stunned by this book. You know, I've read it before, but this time through, I'm blown away by it. It's beyond good. I mean, it needs five plus stars so far.
Yeah. I've never before ever been able to say I had a favorite book, but after rereading it this last time, I have to say this is probably the best book I've ever read now that I understand it more.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I'm just like, I could reread this book for the rest of my life.
Yeah. What he accomplished here is stunning. Mm-hmm. I mean, really, really is. Mm-hmm. So it's going to be wonderful to talk about. I'm a little more than a third of the way through it right now.
Okay.
I didn't read any yesterday, so I'm still in the Riders of Rohan chapter.
Oh, well, good, because I'm keeping up with you as you
go.
Since I just read it fairly recently, I'm kind of going back through it according to your pace.
So cruising right along.
Slow is okay.
Yeah, you bet. And slow is the way to read this. And yeah, anyway, I don't get to start talking about Lord of the Rings. But anyway, enjoying it immensely, So, but okay. So I guess we'll see everybody in a couple of weeks then.
Yeah.
Thank you very much for hanging with us. And thanks for listening.
Yeah, we appreciate it.
All right. See ya. Bye-bye. Need somebody to help me say it one time.